How many feminists does it take to change a light bulb?
Hey, wait a minute. That's a regular light bulb. Where's the ladies' light bulb?
Feminists have told us over and over, gender is a social construct. There is no difference between the sexes. Any social standard, norm, stereotype, or expectation that is based on a belief in biological differences between the sexes is wrong, discriminatory, and oppressive. Well, unless sex differences are advantageous to feminist narratives. Nobody ever said grifters were consistent. We've seen this in feminist narratives on work and pay, on intimate partner and sexual violence, and on parental and reproductive rights. The formula seems to be, women can do everything good that men can do and have all the good skill, talent, and trait potential that men have, but are exempt or excluded from everything to do with men that could be criticized. Meanwhile, everything that can be criticized about women is worse and indicative of a gender trait when men do it or exhibit it. Men cannot need everything women need, and any disadvantage men face must be traced back to masculinity and male power. Those twisted standards have been used to excuse gendering society's handling of a variety of issues, including resources for medical research and treatment. Enter autism spectrum disorders. According to AutismSpeaks.org, autism, or autism spectrum disorder, refers to a broad range of conditions characterized by challenges with social skills, repetitive behaviors, speech, and nonverbal communication. According to the Centers for Disease Control, autism affects an estimated 1 in 59 children in the United States today, coming from all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups, with 3 out of 4 affected being boys. That last statistic is coming under question as concerns have been raised that autistic girls are more likely to go undiagnosed, be misdiagnosed with another disorder, or be diagnosed later in life due to failure of medical practitioners to recognize their symptoms or attribute them to an autism spectrum disorder. In her article for The Guardian, "I was diagnosed with autism in my 40s. It's not just a male condition," Nicola Clark referred to a survey by the UK's National Autistic Society with a sample size of 8,000, which found that women and girls are more likely to be misdiagnosed than men and boys, 41% as opposed to 30%. In addition, they are often older when diagnosed. She related her own experience of living with the condition and her response to finally being diagnosed in adulthood, including her creation of the hashtag, #SheCan'tBeAutistic. A little research revealed that resources for people on the autism spectrum have mostly the same divide that exists in other resources. There are many that are not sex-specific, and there are some that are female-specific. This appears to be a result of the assumption that resources that aren't designed specifically for girls are designed to exclude them. Now, in most instances, my first reaction would be a massive facepalm. We don't, in general, say this about things that are not male-specific. In general, it's not true about things that are not female-specific, either. However, a key issue experienced by people on the autism spectrum is social awkwardness. And socialization is gender-specific in many ways, both in how the individual does it and in what other people might expect of the individual. It's very possible that these disorders' presentation is very different in boys and men than in girls and women. If that is the case, it is entirely fair to advocate for sex-specific resources, and it is entirely fair to point out that expectations based on one sex's presentation might not help the other sex obtain accurate diagnoses. Both sexes, in that case, deserve resources that are sex-specific. Unfortunately, it's looking like gender differences and autism spectrum presentation are being made into a feminist issue. Though it happens to women and girls more, various diagnostic failures do hit both sexes. The reasons are even similar, including the individual learning to cope with symptoms that have gone unaddressed during his or her childhood prior to being diagnosed. That's not because doing so is easy, but because failure to do so has consequences that, when experienced repeatedly, train the child to bluff or limp their way through life. Both sexes are asking for help from a medical community that has been faced with an expanding understanding of the spectrum for decades. These factors lead to symptom masking among both sexes. The difference may be that men and boys simply have greater difficulty pulling that off. Both ends of feminism's narrative on sex differences would be detrimental to people on the autism spectrum. On one hand, the idea that there are no sex differences could make it difficult to determine the need for sex-specific treatment options and other resources. On the other, the idea that if there are sex differences, they're only detrimental to women and in a discriminatory, victimizing way could be detrimental to treatment of male patients. While it's not wrong for women like Clark to seek to reduce the incidence of diagnostic failure affecting girls, it's absolutely wrong for it to be treated like it's only a problem when it happens to girls. And while it's not wrong to fight for accuracy in diagnostics, if the goal of accuracy were to be overshadowed by an interest in increasing the representation of women and girls in autism, that'd be terrible. Getting misdiagnosed as autistic isn't any better than getting misdiagnosed with something else. It still subjects the patient to attempts at therapies that probably won't address his or her specific needs. But that's kinda how feminism works, isn't it? It's not about whether the narrative suits the needs of its subjects, but rather how representation of the subject's interests can be twisted to suit the narrative. Autism doesn't need feminism, but have feminist grifters set their sights on the spectrum? Well, after searching for female-specific resources on autism, I did a search for male-specific resources. Nothing actually matching my search came up until I put the phrase, "resources for autistic boys," in quotes. Then I was given a single, lone result. A 2016 post to Reddit's r/AskFeminist titled, "Are there any good feminist resources for autistic men?" Good feminist resources? No. No, there are not. Hello and welcome to HBR Talk 92, A Social Construct by Any Other Name. I'm your host, Hannah Wallen, here with the lovely and intelligent Anna Cherry, that adorable specter of death, Prim Reaper, and nonsense annihilator, Lauren B., to talk about feminists and autism. But first, as usual, we've got a couple of things to go over. If you haven't already, you need to head on over to badgerfeed.com and register to receive notifications if you want to know what the badgers have going on every day. If you want to support our work despite the latest adpocalypse, feedthebadger.com is the most stable way to help. So remember, information is power and we have it. Go to BadgerFeed for information and Feed the Badger to help us share that information. And speaking of sharing information, don't forget to smash that like button and share us on every social media site you use. Grab some popcorn, throw open the gates of reason, and unleash your friendly neighborhood badgers on normie society. There's lots to talk about. For instance, biology is sexist, guys, but ignoring biology is also sexist. You see how that works?
God. It's crazy how they do this. They focus on, oh my gosh, if the focus is not explicitly on women, then that must mean it's excluding women. And it's like we can talk until we're blue in the face about how, oh yeah, of course, you know, the way that women and men tend to behave is quite different. And therefore the presentation of a lot of different mental disorders, mental concerns, things like that. Of course, they're going to have different presentations in men and women. But if we're not focusing exclusively on women, it's not enough now. It just seems ridiculous.
Yeah. The only thing that I could say to that is that, yes, I totally agree with you. However, I do think in certain situations that a different approach to, you know, therapy can be taken towards, you know, for men and women. So, you know, if you want to say that women need a specific type of therapy when it comes to dealing with, you know, these disorders, okay, I might go for that, you know, but to specifically focus on women and say that, you know, the focus has to be on women is wrong to me. You know, it doesn't take everything into consideration, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. I think having a different therapy style for men and women would actually be like better in a lot of cases, despite what some people might say. I think like we know that men and women tend to learn in different ways. I think that men and women also tend to heal in different ways in a lot of cases, not always, but in a lot of cases.
Well, and we also do know that the presentation of autism is different in boys and girls and in men and women. And that research doesn't surprise me that misdiagnosis might be a little more common in girls, simply because girls are taught from early in their childhood that fitting in is very important. And fitting in includes being good at social stuff, basically. Like all the stuff I suck at, girls are supposed to be really great at that. And
some of that does have to do with the brain structures. In fact, there's a theory called the female protective effect of the differences, the actual sex differences in the brain do affect how autism portrays itself in each gender. In fact, there's a theory of autism called the extreme masculinization of the brain, is what some people, extreme male brain theory, EMB theory, is basically, are we looking at autistic brain as a hyper-masculinized brain? Well, possibly. But I mean, before I get into that, which I can and will and want to, I will just point out the fact that, yes, they do manifest differently. And it has to do with the essentially the presence of testosterone and how that affects brain structures, as well as the areas of the brain that are naturally different between men and women. But in general, we have in various studies, together with anecdotal evidence, have come up that men-women ratios range from 2-to-1 and all the way to 16-to-1. So there was a 1943 study that found that autism was prevalent in boys 4 times as often as in girls. Hans Asperger, the guy who, you know, whose Asperger's is named after him, thought that women and girls were not actually affected by autistic psychopathy at all in 1944, but he did change his mind later because, I mean, we're talking about the 40s. But then we're talking about research in 1981. Lorna Wing found that sex ratios in early childhood autism among people with high functioning autism, or as it's known, Asperger syndrome, were 15 times more in boys than in girls. While people with learning difficulties were a ratio of 2 boys to 1 girl. So we're talking about high functioning autism versus just mild learning differences versus extreme autism. And the ratio does change, but it goes from 2-to-1 all the way to 16-to-1. Much later, 1993 study of Asperger syndrome in Sweden, the ratio of boys to girls were 4-to-1. In 2009, Brugge's survey of adults found in England that 1.8% of boys surveyed were diagnosed, compared to 0.2% of women and girls. And in 2015, the ratio of men to women, supported by the National Autistic Society, was adult services specifically, was approximately 3-to-1. So these are for adults, and the ratio for boys and girls in charity schools was 5-to-1. So there's clearly differences between high functioning autism, also known as Asperger's, versus, you know, learning impaired autism. And then there's childhood autism as well as adult autism. So as we go through life, as Hannah was saying, there is an element of being forced to fit in a way that, perhaps deviates women that are in such an environment that forces them to fit in. Because, for instance, Hannah clearly was allowed to just be herself. And I also, as somebody on the spectrum, was allowed to just be myself, because growing up in Russia, I had everything around me was geared towards, you know, being smart and learning things and not necessarily being that good socially. That wasn't an important thing whatsoever. I wasn't treated like a normal girl. And a lot of the girls that I knew were not treated like quote unquote normal girls either. I mean, we were fighting over each other who would finish the math problem in school first. Like that was what a popular girl, you know, the girl that was beloved by everyone did. She finished the math problem first. She didn't like buy some shoes. So there was sort of that cultural difference that allowed me to remain on the spectrum. But in other places, in America or otherwise, where there's more focus on the social aspect of femininity, almost certainly there are ways in which we, and this is maybe true for men as well, when men are seen as awkward or weird or gay or whatever, because of the way that they naturally have a difference in their brain, they also may be forced away from extreme autism into more normalized, more neurotypical way of being if they're not too deep into the spectrum. And so we see the split between boys and girls versus men and women, it actually narrows. But if we talk about autism itself, in many cases, girls and women have advantage in the areas of folk psychology that support the formation and maintenance of dyadic relationships. And these include advantages in language fluency and comprehension, interpreting facial expressions and gestures, and correctly inferring the thoughts and feelings of other people, known as the theory of mind. Girls and women have small to moderate, and this is a study found this, that girls and women have small to moderate advantages in these individual areas, even while being on the spectrum. So there's already a sort of a sex difference, even in the autism spectrum. And there was a Baron Coates that produced sex differences, and they found that combining all the social cues and looking at differences and things like that, there are ways in which we conceive of folk psychology, such as, you know, girls are better at language and they're better with kids and boys are better at tools. It found that this is true. It did. That is just what is found. I'm sorry, like, to tell you people, but there is a gender difference in the way that we approach things. And these differences are highlighted in autism spectrum. So sometimes it's said that women with autism are hiding in plain sight because they do have advantages on things like language and theory of mind that we typically see as missing or lacking in their complexity in people with autism spectrum. But in fact, there's an entire idea that it's called FPE, the female protective effect. It's a theory that under this theory, a higher rate of ASD, autism spectrum disorder, risk factors should be observed in the average affected female compared to their affected male counterpart. These additional risk factors are required for the female to surpass the higher clinical threshold. So because of the gender differences, there's a protective, essentially, effect by the virtue of having extra myelin and other things that women have. Go ahead.
It's funny. It's only these kinds of groups that would take the fact that women actually have an easier time with a certain disorder and then transform that into a discussion about how, oh my God, women are less likely to get diagnosed with autism. Clearly, this is a problem for women.
Yes, instead of focusing on the fact that there are there's gender dimorphism in the brain. There are certain brain areas. They're different between men and women. Different doesn't mean bad. Like, people,
whoa,
come
clearly.
On.
So if it's negatively affecting boys more often, then maybe the focus ought to be on boys who have autism, right?
Right. Like, everything doesn't have to be about you, ladies.
Yeah, no, this is definitely an area where the sexes themselves, both sexes deserve their sex-specific treatments and their sex-specific therapy options and maybe sex-specific evaluation as well. But we're looking at a situation where, because girls are able to fit in a little better and because it does possibly delay or cause misdiagnosis, you're looking at a situation where the other end of it is boys don't necessarily mask their symptoms as easily, and even with therapies and treatments, they may have a rougher time having more functional outcomes in society. You know, things like if they're lower functioning on the spectrum, they may have a rougher time being able to be self-supporting. They may be closer to the disability end of the spectrum, and they may be on the disability end of the spectrum more often. Now, I've seen the manifestation of the disability end of the spectrum in females, and it's just as rough as it is at that end on males. And there's a lot of things that you have in common between the sexes in how to handle the symptoms, the things that actually happen, the difficulty with light and noises and unexpected things and stuff like that, that becomes even more challenging when the person cannot communicate effectively or at all. It becomes sort of closer together how you handle it at that end of the spectrum. But you're going to see a situation where even being higher functioning isn't necessarily as enabling for guys as it is for gals.
Well, exactly. There's a way in which men also hide in plain sight when they do have autism that isn't extreme, because in keeping with the universally and potentially just evolved basis, anthropologists are beginning to find that many of the sex differences that people live in traditional societies versus Western societies, for instance, Kashdan and colleagues demonstrated that the male advantage in spatial cognition that is found in Western populations is also found in traditional cultures. And we see that with autism spectrum, that men are better at spatial navigation and spatial abilities and keeping up with tools. And then also that manifests in the sort of social disconnect. So all we see are these men that are like really good workers or really good, let's say cogs in the Western industrial machine. And then we see them as cold or unfeeling or arrogant or aggressive or not thinking of other people's thoughts. Well, that's because they're on the spectrum and we just don't see them as that because they have these benefits that we have socially accepted as a good thing for our society. But we are missing the fact that they come from autism and that these men are actually on the spectrum and they're also hiding in plain sight. In fact, as Hans Asperger himself said as well, which led to the theory, the extreme male brain theory of autism, it says that there are morphological and functional differences, there are, between male and female brains, but the autistic brain is a more extreme, hyper-masculinized version of the male brain, possibly due to the elevated FT. I think that's a testosterone thing. And there are certain tests on which, men with autism score much higher than regular men that are male-ified. And even women with autism have these also exaggerations of the male brain phenotype. And so researchers are now actually moving slightly away from the extremely masculinized brain theory and are, because there's some findings that contradict it, such as women themselves being protected, for instance, from this malification through their unique female physiology of the brain. And some researchers are looking at the fact that perhaps what is happening, that the authors suggest that maybe ASD may not involve hypermasculinization per se, but a general dysfunction of sex differentiation. So not, once again, we're going back to autism is very curious and interesting in that sense, because it is sits right at the core of this very controversial idea that male and female brains are different, that we have different anatomy features of the gray matter. Some areas of the brain are different in size. There's different connections, more or less connections in certain areas of the brain. That is incontrovertible fact. However, a lot of the people who go into autism, not necessarily research, but those who are affected by autism or want to help autism, they come at it from a psychology perspective. They come at it from a sociology, from a person, humanities perspective. However, they are missing the biology, the hard science perspective that is crucial and is at the core of autism. And so once again, I feel like it's projection maybe. I don't know what it is where this there's this mortal panic and fear in the gynocentrist circles or the feminist circles to give men any attention about anything. It's almost like they fear that the moment we give men attention, they're just going to hog it all up and there's going to be none left for anyone else. Well, you know what? Girls do that. Okay. That's just projection. I don't think focusing on a disorder will somehow let these people off the hook or, you know, in some way, make them lazy, or I don't even know what could be possibly going in their brain that prevents so many feminist groups from giving men direct attention that isn't shared by anyone else, but just men. Like, what is so wrong with that?
Yeah, this is one of the things that bothered me about what I was reading regarding women on the spectrum and girls on the spectrum. And like, it's, yes, it's important to look at, all right, this hits women and girls differently than it hits men and boys. And there may be specific problems that one sex has that the other sex doesn't, or that hit one sex harder and other problems hit the other sex harder. And I just don't like the, well, therefore we need to focus on women and girls. And to the exclusion of men and boys. Well, no, it means therefore men and boys might need a men and boys specific focus, and women and girls might need a women and girls specific focus, and that's okay. And it's almost like feminists can't seem to reconcile their narrative about gender being a social construct with their narrative about women and girls being more vulnerable and needing more resources. And so anytime anything comes up where biology is actually the reason why women and girls might need specific resources, suddenly they have to be victim of that. And suddenly it has to be men and boys are taking it all, or men and boys have all the focus, and somehow that's sexist when it's not necessarily.
Well, biology is just, this is what's coming next. Biology is just a social construct.
Oh, God. Only when it's only when it's convenient for them, though.
So I'm sorry, why do we need feminism then if gender is a social construct?
Yeah, there we go.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not real.
Yeah. It's not, I don't know. It's just silly. It's like men aren't allowed to have a single thing that's more tailored towards them and their needs. It just feels like if everything isn't focused on women first, then somehow that's a problem. Drives me nuts.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed also, and this is just from me, I sort of feel like I've studied social interaction between people as an outsider, like as not a people sometimes. And it's like, I don't even have a diagnosis. I've just had everybody in my life tell me that I should have one, including my parents, and who took me to a psychiatrist when I was 4, right? To see if I was autistic. Well, when I was 4, I don't think they were even diagnosing high functioning autism very much. That would have been 1978, I think, was when they took me. It would either have been 78 or 79. And I don't even know if Asperger's was an actual diagnosis at that time. But and then the psychiatrist didn't know what to do with me. Like, he basically said, well, this doesn't look like anything that I have seen in the manual. There's no disorder here. She's just maturing slower socially, and she'll catch up with the other kids, and she's maturing intellectually faster than the other kids, and they'll catch up with her. And one of those two things happened, and it wasn't the social one. I kind of wonder, I've always kind of wondered, but I've never really felt like the woman whose article I highlighted, she felt like it was important to get a diagnosis. And it made a big difference to her to have that diagnosis. It doesn't feel like that for me. I don't feel like I got to get a diagnosis, and I can accept that this might be a possibility. I definitely do things that are classic, if you know what I mean. And so I looked around at the people around me and the way they socialize versus me and the way I socialize. And it gave me kind of a, not necessarily a unique view of it, but I've watched differences between men and women and how they interact with each other and how they deal with each other and respect each other and treat each other and everything. And when Gamergate started, I wrote about some of that, the social ladder, and how there's a couple of rungs or a couple of levels below the bottom rung of the social ladder that are populated almost entirely by guys. And I think part of that is guys that are autistic but high functioning don't necessarily They're even more of an outsider than I am, right? They don't necessarily, not just don't necessarily fit in, but don't necessarily know how to make other people comfortable with their presence in a group of people. Like, to the degree where people will actively seek to avoid them. And because I used to hang out with a lot of different people, including guys that were that low down on the social ladder. And because I just really don't care about social stuff. I care about, is the person interesting? Does the person have, you know, neat things to talk about? Is the person interesting to be around and stuff? And pretty much everybody is. There's something interesting about everybody. But that seems to hit guys in a way that it doesn't hit women. And I like there. I mean, there might have been two or three gals to, you know, 20 guys in that social circle, or rather, social crowd. Because it wasn't a lot of that. It's not. You're not in that social circle because you decide you want to hang out with that group of people. You're in that social circle because it's all that's left. And that's something that I think the reason that women and girls may be not getting diagnosed, and they may be able to chameleon themselves into the rest of society, is because they're able to chameleon themselves out of that group. Guys that are in that same level of symptom manifestation, the same presentation of social awkwardness, it's cute, right? When girls do it, everybody's, oh, that's cute. She's so awkward. She, you know, she can't come up with the right words or this or that. That's so adorable. And when a guy does it, they treat it like it's creepy, or they treat it like it's inconvenient, or it's, you know, if it's not threatening and it's not inconvenient, it's just off-putting, right? So you get a totally different reaction in society. That creates a situation where society refuses to see those men and recognize those men and those boys. And they do end up in a position where if they're the type to seek help, or if they have family members who would push them to seek help, they'll be recognized in the medical community as having a problem. Whereas, you know, gals, because it's cute when she can't come up with the right words, or it's cute when she has to have the best chair in the room, you know, or it's cute when she does the wrong dance to the right song, or the right dance to the wrong song, or says the wrong lyrics to the right song, that would hide, you know, a gal's presentation. That would hide from most society, and they would be less likely to go seek help. They would be less likely to have friends and family members pressure them to seek help, and they might even be less likely to say, well, you know, this is actually a problem and I should do something about it.
Oh yeah. And on that note, like a lot of the symptoms of autism that are like in the social realms, in struggling to interact with others, if a girl finds it awkward to talk with people, she's considered cute. Whereas if a guy finds it awkward to talk with people, he might be more likely to be considered creepy or something like that, and therefore looked down upon, whereas that's not so much the case for girls.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I myself find it very hard to just strike up a conversation. I'm not that kind of person, you know. I've never found conversation comfortable unless I'm talking about something that I'm passionate about. And even then, you know, I'm always critiquing myself, you know, did I say the right word? Did I pronounce it the right way or the wrong, you know, it's crippling. It really is. You know, I get around people and I just want to disappear, you know, but I find my own comfort zone and I can flourish within that. So yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do that to an extent. I know I sure do, yeah. But I think that's more just of a, you know, perfectionist self anxiety. I got to critique myself because I have to be perfect for everybody kind of thing, rather than a, you know, an autism related thing. But you know, it's a common thing that a lot of people deal with.
I mean, I think for me, it's a little more intense than that, because I mean, I just don't even know how to relate to people. I don't even know what to bring up as a topic of conversation, because, you know, politically, I have such very strong beliefs, or I, you know, I think a certain way about certain things. And I know that it's not how most people would think, you know. So I know politics is a sore subject. It's not something that I want to bring up. You know, I don't think that a lot of people are going to agree with me. And in the cases when I do find someone who does, it's like, wow, all right, here's someone I can at least have a base level of, you know, understanding and with. But even then, like, I don't live the kind of life that most people live. I don't have kids. You know, I don't have a lot of friends or family around me, you know, so I don't have the same kind of experiences that most people do. So I don't even know how to have conversations with people sometimes. And so I avoid them.
Yeah,
which is bad.
Well, I don't, it kind of depends on how much. Like,
yeah.
My, you know, my mom was a social butterfly when she was in school, and I, of course, got to hear about that. And it was, she was a little different in that way than me. And I thought, well, since my mom was a social butterfly, I gotta be a social butterfly too, because that's, like, just the way little girls think, I guess. And that was disastrous. So I think the worst, probably thing out of that, I mean, it was disastrous, but it wasn't disastrous in a horrible, lifelong, traumatic way. Probably the worst experience I had with it in school was sitting down at a table full of girls and they all got up and moved, which really makes you feel great, right? But
well, see, I avoided all that by just reading all the time through
all
the lunches by myself.
I had girls that were, you know, wanted to be my friends, and at that moment I was just like, well, screw this, this is bullshit, you know, I'm not gonna put myself through that. And I was 16 when I decided I know I'm never gonna be popular, and I'm not gonna try, right? I'm not gonna do that. That's not important.
Question: did that make you more popular when you gave up trying?
Yeah.
it usually does.
I was like, you know, fuck this shit, I'm out of here. You know, I went and sat with the girls that actually wanted to hang out with me were older than me too. That was the funny thing. Like, there were two gals that were younger than me and two gals that were older than me, but my sophomore year in high school, the gals that were younger than me, you know, they weren't in school with me, they were still in junior high, they were neighbors. And when I did start hanging out with them, it was when I was a junior and senior and they were in high school. But I was hanging out with seniors my sophomore year in high school, which apparently is a social thing as well. They're people I knew from 4-H. So
the power of going your own way, man.
I guess. And I but that whole thing, like, I was like, all right, well, I'm Liza Doolittle, obviously, at the horse race, where she doesn't get that everybody else is rooting for the horses quite silently, and she starts muttering and then starts speaking louder, you know, and then finally she tells the horse to move its bloomin' arse, and everybody looks at her like, what the hell? And where she ends up, like, she gets a script, right? Talk about these things. These things are normal social conversation, but the way she talks about them is definitely not okay for polite society. That's me in a nutshell, right? So I'm not going to be popular. Screw that. And the next thing you know, my senior year, I managed to host a party for my classmates, and that it's like it had a huge group of people showed up for it. I was really shocked. I thought, you know, my parents wanted me to do this, and a couple of the gals wanted to do it, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have five people show up because I'm the one throwing the party. And no, it was actually one of the biggest parties of the year. It was also one of the only two parties at which there was no alcohol. We had chaperones because that's not, like I said, I didn't party like the other kids either. But this is a difference in, you know, how people interact and everything. Gals don't usually give up on socializing. They do the run scripts, you know, fit in here thing, where it's like, well, you know that in this circumstance, you're supposed to talk about the weather. You know that in this circumstance, if somebody has asked you about your day, it's polite to ask about theirs too. And even though it has no purpose to ask about each other's days, well, that's okay. That's small talk. You're supposed to do it. And you know that in this circumstance, even though the person might not be thirsty, it's comforting to offer them a drink. I think that one actually made it into the portrayal. I'm pretty sure, what's the character's name? Sheldon from
The Big Bang Theory
is a portrayal of Asperger's. And he has that phrase he uses, what's the social protocol for this? And I'm pretty sure women and gals are very good at figuring out the basic social protocol, even if it doesn't make sense to them, and they can sort of parallel it. I think that portrayal is as campy and stupid as pretty much every portrayal in a sitcom. Like they everything is stereotyped in a sitcom. Everything is a caricature in a sitcom because it's supposed to make people laugh. So it wouldn't be something that you would look at that character and go, yeah, that's a great example of this or that. But that one thing is a pretty good description of at least what I've seen women doing. And I think men have a harder time. Boys and men have a harder time learning to do that. And they have a harder time learning to recognize the situations when they should be doing that. And I think that's part of the reason why they are... why they're more likely to get pointed out by society, and why they're more likely to get treated as outsiders by society under that circumstance, and therefore why they're more likely to either seek help or be forced into it. So someone in the chat was saying the author said that he wasn't, but you know they certainly put a lot of identifiable characteristics into him. And I think that's true, Neat Scholar says, but I think they just had no clue that they actually were. It might be that they're putting their own personality traits into the people in the show. And there may be an undiagnosed patient there as well. So you never know. And then we have Albert Nada gave us $5 Canadian and said, lasses, please check out my North Country monologue. I'd like to hear your perspectives. Thank you. And we will have to do that, but definitely sometime after the show. So, but as we're, and somebody said they couldn't give a super chat. If that's happening, I'm sorry, I don't have any control over it. But I guess if we can't do that, then we can't do that. We'll just have to, you know, Feed the Badger works better anyway. We get more out of Feed the Badger than we do out of Super Chats. YouTube actually takes the lion's share of every Super Chat. And sometimes, if they decide that our subject matter isn't appropriate, they just take the Super Chats. So,
oh, God.
Yeah.
There's potentially a way around that through Streamlabs. So...
I know that we've been
my go-to.
We've been working with Streamlabs, but I haven't got access to it yet. So,
yes, you have to keep doing the thing until the automated system decides that you're worthy of the donations.
There you go. Yeah, that's basically our situation. So, but in any case, Anna, I know you had done, you talked about all of the research that you had done? Had you gotten to get that all in? Because I know you had done a lot of research, for the show.
Yeah. There's more essentially, but, they're just basically, papers that, we can share in the low bar or wherever. But yeah, essentially it's, is the fact that, so we do have, you know, the gender differences in terms of the split between diagnoses between men and women. So I definitely covered that. There are the theories that explain the gender split, like the female. So some of the ideas on that I can touch upon that I didn't touch is in TLDR form. Where's the TLDR? that there's a female, you know, these groups voicing their concern that we do need to update the, and I believe that that was the case with heart attacks as well, that we have this idea of heart attacks based on how men have them. So the tingling down the arm and things like that, but women have heart attacks in a different way. So they're insane with autism. Their women present in different ways from men. Once again, underscoring gender difference that exists. So we need to have diagnostic tests for women that are modified in a way that actually catches autism in women. And so, yeah, autism is an exaggeration of normal gender differences. So in the past, we thought it was the extreme male brain theory of autism could possibly be causing it by the FT, which is the fetal testosterone. So the fetal testosterone that affects brain development has been thought to cause autism as extreme male brain theory. But there are some things in particular, let's see, what exactly are the things? I had it here somewhere. There are differences in which women present that kind of gave people pause on the idea of the extreme male brain theory. And so they're trying to find another way around it, which they're talking about being a exaggeration of the normal gender differences, which I'm not entirely sure if I buy that until I know see a little more research on it. But there are findings that counter to what is predicted by the extreme male brain theory. Such as, for example, study of DMN. I don't know what DMN is, unfortunately. Oh, the default mode network. I see. Another recent report indicated an exaggeration of a male brain phenotype, specifically lower connectivity in the default mode network, which is a group of interacting brain areas with correlated activity associated with social processing. So this default mode network processes social interactions, and we see an issue with it. And the exaggerated male brain, which men, of course, have a bit of a harder time with this default mode network because, as folk wisdom suggests, women are better at social interactions. And it is proven by such things as the activity of the default mode network in women, the group of interacting brain areas that associates with social processing. And it is dysfunctional in ASD. So some research, though, found that the differences in this default mode network in a control population, but it had reduced connectivity to the prefrontal cortex that was correlated in males only, but not in women. So if it's an exaggeration of the male brain, then we should see women being more male, women with autism being more male-like, but they're not seeing every single dot matching one-to-one in men and women. So the predictions of the extreme male brain theory are not quite coming true in the way that they would hope. And a more recent analysis of the default mode network, the whole brain connectivity in a resting state found that ASD males actually had a feminized profile of hypoconnectivity compared to control males, and women had a masculinized expression of increased connectivity. So here we see, you know, autistic male brains behaving in a way that is closer to women's brains, and then autistic women's brains are behaving closer to male brains. So they're like, ah, what's happening? So they're suggesting that it may not be hypermasculinization per se, but a general dysfunction of these specific sex differences that already exist in the brain. And of course, there's an investigation of neuroanatomical features of gray and white matter in the areas of the brain associated with ASD. And in women, they appear to be masculinized, but other regions do not appear to be hypermasculinized the same regions do not appear to be hypermasculinized in men. So they're like, well, women are becoming more hypermasculinized in this particular way in which men are not. So like, just what is happening? There's definitely much more research that is coming out currently, and researchers are looking for alternative theories. And it seems to be the exaggeration of normal gender differences is where it's at. But I would say that there's still that both theories are perhaps true, that we, or rather, there's something we have not yet quite discovered, perhaps maybe an effect of testosterone on certain areas or effect or interaction of estrogen and testosterone through development, because the extreme male brain theory is based on fetal testosterone effects, which is why we can diagnose autism so early in children, because a lot of that just essentially happens in vitro, in the womb. But there are also genetic differences that show girls are less likely to inherit autism than boys. And overall, men and boys tend to be more susceptible to organic damage than women. And this was found by Rimland in 1964, whether through hereditary disease, acquired infection, or other conditions. Since it is now almost universally accepted that there's an organic cause for autism, it is possible that boys are more likely to be autistic because they don't have the protections of myelin and other things that, that women do. And of course, women and girls are better at masking or camouflaging their difficulties. And autism traits in girls are underreported by teachers for whatever reasons. And sometimes gender dysphoria can be something that causes issues or interferes with the whole autism thing. So sometimes things that can be seen as autism are actually manifestations of gender dysphoria, and those who are actually born with their brain being different. I mean, this is also fact. We have research evidence to point to, for instance, and I've mentioned this before, that gay men, their brains activate like straight women, and gay women's brains activate like straight men in MRIs. So there are gender dysphoria, to me, if we look at the brain and we see that it fires in a way that is inconsistent with a person's assigned gender, and they report having dysphoria, they absolutely have dysphoria. It's, we can't, gender is not something that's between our legs, it's between our ears. It is a levels of hormones and fetal testosterone, and actually fetal cortisol too. There's evidence to suggest that when mothers are stressed in the third trimester, it actually increases the likelihood of their sons being born gay, and the way that the cortisol affects the immune system and how it attacks the fetus. And there's just a lot of stuff to do with biological sex differences, and we have to, and just the way the brain is, and there's no magical gender thing. It is a correlation or an interaction of hormones and brain structures, and we can look at the brain increasingly in deeper ways and see how they behave. And to me, gender dysphoria is a real thing. However, you have to look at the brain to see if it's there. You can't just rely on self-reporting, because a lot of times, especially impressionable younger kids, they want to fit in, they want to be cool, they may, you know, jump on certain bandwagons that are not necessarily indicative of what is going on. Because as we see, Generation Z, the new generation, the currently teenage and growing in their early 20s generation, are the biggest generation that has anxiety and depression. So there are social pressures and environmental pressures on our youngest generation, and they are experiencing dysphoria of some type or another, but it's not necessarily gender dysphoria, you know? So there's a lot that goes into brain differences and gender, and we need to look at it. It is a disservice to boys and girls and men and women and queer folks to ignore gender differences in the brain that can be easily assessed and pointed to by neuroscience. And so there's, you know, just a lot of information there that can interfere with how we diagnose autism because of things like gender dysphoria or other brain differences. Non-neurotypicality doesn't always have to be autism, but a lot of times it is. But of course, as we said, there's a big difference in how men and women present it. And so we need to look at gender identity and how that connects with autism. And, you know, from personal experience, I absolutely, you know, I wasn't necessarily treated as a girl, and I definitely am on the spectrum, but I don't feel like, I mean, I love being feminine, you know, like once I discovered that I could be feminine, long hair, heels, skirts, hyper feminine, whatever markings, like earrings and lipstick, like I love all of it and I embrace it and I feel like I am feminine. However, TMI, I don't understand why I have a vagina. Like why, what is that? Where's my penis? I don't understand. So from personal anecdotal evidence, there's definitely this interesting interaction between what could be perceived as gender dysphoria that is actually perhaps a manifestation of autism, which is sort of why I lean towards the extreme masculine brain theory, because from everything that I see, it definitely is a shift towards the masculine spectrum in both men and women, to the point where, you know, it becomes disabling, such as lack of theory of mind, lack of being able to connect with others or understand what they're thinking or saying, and the social issues that come from saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. But at the same time, I also see autism as actually, you know, we had a podcast or a Cherry Stime episode on this, that it's mankind 2.0, that there's evidence. And in my opinion, there is my theory that essentially autism saved us from being primates, that it was a desire for the fire thing, pyromania, and just liking fire in general is an autistic thing. And tool making and a desire to work with tools is a masculine slash autistic thing. So I believe that we got brought out of the caves by autism. And it's actually just the next evolutionary step for us being more tool makers instead of socializers, because the primate brain, we've had the same brains as primate. We have the same brain structures as primates do, and we've had it for a really, really long time. And what primates are bad at is tools, and they haven't really come out of the trees. But what they're really, really, really good at is social interactions. They have entire hierarchies and pecking orders and, you know, a rich society with interactions between them. So the social aspect is nothing new. That's what we already had. It was the building of things and becoming more in tune with machines rather than with other people is what caused us to become civilized. And that's why we can thank man and autism for building civilizations and cities for us. So I don't see autism as a disability on the whole. However, obviously, when you're high, deep in the spectrum, it does cause issues. And we do need to find some sort of happy middle. But, you know, I don't see autism as a bad thing. But we need to stop having a disservice to all of us by ignoring gender differences and how autism and gender and everything else interacts in the brain. And we can look at it now. Neuroscience has progressed massively in the past 15 years. So, you know, we need to kind of stop buying into the outdated ideas that feminism keeps pushing and actually do a service to our queer and gay people and to autistic women by looking more at brain research.
And we can do that with men and boys as well, I think, by looking at, all right, if we're going to see more men and boys in the men and boys on the spectrum whose level of function places them at a greater disadvantage than women and girls at that same level, until you get to a level where it's just such a disadvantage that it doesn't matter what sex you are, you're in trouble, right? In terms of being able to be self-supporting and independently living. But at the higher ends of it, where, you know, the person can maybe have a job, the person can maybe live on their own, do their own budgeting, live in society, within society, as a law-abiding citizen who doesn't necessarily get into trouble all the time, you're going to see more guys have difficulties with maintaining that job, maintaining their social connections, maintaining their ability to stay out of trouble with their neighbors over things like misunderstandings that are based on you're not picking up your neighbor's social cues, you're not understanding what your neighbor's trying to communicate and stuff like that. So the therapies that would need to be specific to the sexes, obviously guys might need a little more support at the moderate and higher functioning ends and being able to engage with the rest of society without having their disorder be a detriment to their ability to maintain their status in society and their employed status and their I'm in good with the neighbors status. People aren't calling the cops on me for being in my backyard status. And people are more likely to accommodate women and girls when they shouldn't versus failing to accommodate men and boys when they should. And I think there was somebody else had something to respond to what Anna said as well.
I was thinking about what she was saying about the masculine brain, and it reminded me, autism topic in general reminded me of a documentary that was put out by the CBC in 2009 called The Disappearing Male. And it was all about the effects of biphenyl A or BPA on boys and how it changes their everything about them, their hormones, the way they develop. And it even affects them in the womb.
Absolutely. The fascinating thing about BPA, and of course, I got to take off my tinfoil fedora here because I'm so tempted, but the one and only, well, not one and only, but the major thing that BPA attacks is the man, prostate cancer. And as you said, changing of their hormones, it is basically a male targeted toxin. It's freaking weird. So I'm really, really happy they've been taking it out of plastic bottles and had the concentrated effort taking BPA out of plastic bottles. So whenever you buy any kind of plastic Tupperware, and especially if you're going to be heating it, which don't, but if you're going to be heating plastic or putting in a dishwasher or just using plastic at all, even handling it, make sure that it says BPA free for sure.
Yeah, this is one I had been reading about that, and then everything that I had found on it before seems to have disappeared. And I had wanted to print out some articles about it, basically because there's a few people I know who really like to put those containers in the dishwasher and reuse them and run the dishwasher's heat cycle for drying and everything. And I'm like, I thought I read that actually is damaging to people, but I haven't been able to find it as easily lately. It's like a lot of that's just sort of, I don't know if Google decided it was unimportant, but I haven't been able to find it on other search engines as easily either. And maybe I just stopped using the right search terms. We had a question in chat, and since our super chats are kind of crippled tonight, I'm going to go ahead and address it, even though it's not a super chat. PowerPlayer1000 asked, "Hey, Anna, I know it might be a bit off topic, although I don't think it is, but I was wondering if neuroscience has anything to say about game theory, about people who see their game character as self versus as tool."
Well, when you say game theory, that is actually a specific keyword, specifically evolutionary game theory. If we're talking about Nash equilibrium, that we've also done cherry stems on that, that I can point you guys to. But I believe this might have been on HBR with Allison, where we talked about evolutionary game theory and how the Nash equilibrium is actually an outdated model. And the prisoner's dilemma and things like that. In fact, it's missing what nature has built into effective group cooperation, which is altruism. But do you mean, because you're talking about seeing a game character, a self versus as a tool. So I'm not sure how you mean game theory in that sense, but there is something that neuroscience says about seeing what I do know, so I will tell you that I'm not sure what you are saying exactly, and I do not necessarily have the research on that because all of that's unfamiliar to me, but I do have research on the way Western versus Asian cultures see self versus other. So there's this really fascinating neuroscience research on the way brain areas activate in, I believe it was Japanese in particular, that whenever they think of self, the areas for mother and family and things like that, specifically mother, activate as well. Versus in US or Western cultures, Europe, wherever, whenever people think of self, only their self area activates. So there's an interesting aspect of thinking of oneself as an isolated creature versus seeing yourself as a bigger group, or at least you're not alone. Whenever you think of yourself, you automatically, your brain areas activate for the people around you. Therefore, you think of yourself as more of a organism And so I think that is actually really important to how we structure societies, in sense of, for instance, in Germany, there is a way, they did this research of German versus Japanese, and they looked at in Asian cultures, everybody at a party stands around in a circle. So that way everyone's part of the group, everyone can see each other, everyone can talk to each other. However, in Germany and in Western cultures, people are grouped by threes and fours in a bunch of little, you know, groups, circles together that are not necessarily communicating with each other, but are sort of isolated. And so between these two things and how much I believe isolation is the cause for not just male suicide, but things like undiagnosed, untreated autism, things like incels, there is a strong element of community and touch and oneness with others that is missing, I believe, in the Western culture. And I think it is leading to issues like inceldom and other problems where men are feeling increasingly isolated. And we're certainly not helping it by not having any male resources and outlawing essentially male gathering places. But, you know, it doesn't have to just be a male gathering place. In some way or another, to have a sense of, I have a support group, I have people that are there for me, this sort of subconscious activation of some other brain area that has to do with an other, while you're thinking about yourself, I think is very powerful to try to help people feel less alone. And I mean, I know Japan has, of course, an incel problem as well. I wouldn't necessarily, it's not necessarily an incel problem per se. I mean, it is, but it's more of a hikikomori, where the men become isolated from society. They stay at home. They don't want to go out. They're basically confine themselves to their room. However, in that state, they kill themselves much less because they have their parents who give them food, who bring them, you know, who essentially allow them to live in their home, bring them food every day to their room, and continue to sort of attempt to supply and support these disabled men. And I know there are groups, particularly in the U.S., who believe that, you know, we just need to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and we need to stop wallowing in a misery and just go out and do it. But when you are disabled, it is no different than a broken leg when you have a broken brain. You need help. You need support. And of course, it needs to have elements of tough love, such as, you know, if you keep constantly leaning on a crutch, you're never going to build your own muscle, but you need to have that crutch to start with, you know. And so I think that we could do men a service by being more empathetic. And if that means giving somebody who you think is a lazy bum extra help, well, you know what? That may be a risk we need to take. We may need to just accept the fear of, well, if we just give them things, they'll never learn to be self-sufficient. Well, you know what? If that happens, when that happens, we can deal with it. But I think we need to be more willing to take that risk, because what we end up doing now is ignoring an ever-growing population of men who need that help and who would just, you know, and this is something Allison tweeted on the Honey Badger Twitter account, that there's research now coming out that men would rather be dead than be seen as vulnerable. So we need to be more okay with giving help to vulnerable people or for those who need help, and not be seeing them as worthless, because that is what leads to suicide. That is what leads to inceldom and then potential, you know, violence that can rise out of that. And just in general, when people feel disenfranchised, when they feel isolated, when they feel even anonymous in a way, because there's been research on that, when you put a mask over somebody else's head, you can, you know, do harm to them much easier. And when you put mask over your own head, you can do harm to others much easier. So there's this element of anonymity, of disenfranchisement, of being cast away from a society that is causing or exacerbating mental health problems. And I think we need to get a little more socialist in terms of our of the emotional currency that we have. You know, let's switch to a concept of abundance. There's plenty of love. There's plenty of support. We will never run out of hugs to give, you know. So we need to just bite the bullet and reach out to men and give them love and give them support. And I know a lot of them are going to not want it. just think of them as tsundere's, the anime characters that act all gruff and pretend that they don't need it and don't want it and don't want to have anything to do with you, but secretly on the inside they're, you know, fluffy, soft little kittens that need to be protected. And I see men as that all the time. They're these hurt, scared, sad little boys that need hugs and need a mother and a father that they never had. And they're putting armor on themselves because they need to, you know, make it in this world because they don't want to be worthless. That's, to men, is a worse fate than death, provably. So we need to make it less painful for, we need to make it less evident to them that we think of them as worthless when they're not producing, when they're not at the top of their game, when they're not just saying everything's okay. And I know it's going to be hard, and it's, they may never accept that help on the surface, but we need to just continue giving it to them because it's what it does under the surface, and how it helps under the surface is what is the important thing.
And I think one of the things you touched on it that's really important is the basically the shrinking of male spaces, like just male spaces where, you know, women aren't really involved, or if women are involved, it's marginal.
Well, and we need that because men don't want to be seen as weak and worthless to women.
Right.
Okay. That's the important part.
Well, and there's also ways in which men socialize and support each other that are very different from the ways women socialize and support each other. I think a lot of how socialization takes place in our society is controlled by normal women. And that's just the way it is. It's not like, that's not a criticism of women, and it's not a praise of women. It's a statement of, this is the environment in which we live. And the problem comes in where if you have, like with autistic men, that extreme masculinity in socialization, they're not going to be socialized like normal women because they're not women and they're not normal, right? So they're going to have problems. And one of the things that I've noticed, just hanging out with groups of guys where a lot of times I'm sort of on the fringes and I'm the only gal in the group and I'm not being a gal out loud, if you know what I mean. So it's I get a chance to observe again. And there are ways in which guys are accepting of each other and able to draw another guy into socialization that are very, very hindered by the way that women socialize and the way that women affect the way a group socializes. And so you see guys that would be on the fringes or excluded completely in a co-ed group able to at least take part in the interaction and maybe pick up some not necessarily skills, but capability of identifying with other people and capability of identifying how they need to, like the scripts basically that they need to run in order to be able to be a part of a group and deal with the socialization that takes place in a co-ed group later on. I guess a good way to put it was, one of the guys that I grew up with, that would hang around the crowd of guys that I hung out with, couldn't learn how to talk to people in a way that wasn't off-putting. And he was excluded from that was because I shut up more often than I didn't in that situation when it was just me and a bunch of guys. But when it was just, him and a bunch of guys, and like I said, I wasn't figuring prominently into the situation, then he could ask questions or they could say, you know, hey, you should do it this way or you should do it that way. And it wasn't upsetting or embarrassing. It was like, okay, I have just been given information. I will process it and make use of it. And it was a totally different thing. But guys can't necessarily always do that in a situation where they're flooded with stimulus from there's a girl over there, there's a girl over there, there's a girl over there. She's looking at me. You know, she sees what I'm doing. She's noticing how I'm acting. She's judging everything I say and do, and freeze. You know, where we hear that for men and women, for men there's fight or flight, and for women there's fight, flight, or freeze. Well, that's where men have their freeze. There's a girl around. Well, I can't be myself.
There's also actually tend and befriend that women have. In fact, it's more frequent that women exhibit tend and befriend, which has some really unique and interesting effects on the physiology of the woman. And she releases oxytocin, actually. And there's also vaginal wetting, curiously, which leads me to believe that tend and befriend completely arose as an evolutionary mechanism to raids on tribes and villages, where Vikings, for instance, come in, they kill all the men, they keep the women as their slaves, and now you have a new husband. What are you going to do? If you're going to fight or flight, well, you're dead because you can't survive in the woods by yourself. And if you try to flee, they're probably just going to kill you if you're not cooperative. So it makes a lot more sense to cooperate and also to prepare your vagina for a ripening. This is fascinating. I'm such a slut for evolutionary psychology and neuroscience. I can't tell you, but yeah, there is actually another way that women, so that's yet another way in which actually women are protected from, or at least find their way to be more normal, like if they are on the spectrum, because there are certain, prolactin estrogen based things that happen in the female brain that allow them literally to be more socially fluid and fluent, and that's just the women's way to survive. Men rely on their strength in order to find their way through society, and women rely on tending and befriending.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why it's so silly that everybody keeps, you know, making this comparison. Oh, men have it. Men have these resources. We need more resources for women. It's like, it's not, we shouldn't look at it like that. You know, it's, they're often going through very different things. It's not a zero sum game. It's not, you know, men have these resources, therefore women don't have these resources. It's like men and women just have very different ways of relating to the world around them. So honestly, we just need different resources for both. It's not just for men or just for women. We need resources for both tailored to their specific needs. I don't understand why so many people have a problem with this. It should just be seen as obvious. But as soon as we start trying to suggest, okay, well, here are some areas where men have fallen behind, maybe we should have some resources targeted to them, you start getting called a misogynist for that. It doesn't make any sense. We just have to challenge that narrative. It's like, no, it's fine. We can do both, guys. It's allowed.
Right. Abundance mindset. We have enough support for everyone. Everyone can get some. It's okay.
Exactly. Oh, God. If anything else, we have so many different people in counseling, right? It's kind of an oversaturated field.
And you know, in regards to therapy, it's not a one size fits all kind of thing. You know, it things that work for one might not work for the other. And yes, there needs to be gendered approaches for those people, you know, for those who it would work benefit, you know, but that doesn't mean that a man wouldn't benefit from therapy that is geared more towards a female centered brain.
Oh, definitely. Like we don't want to make assumptions, but
right.
I think that's where it comes from, you know, just asking people what do you think you need? Does this modality speak to you? You know, that kind of thing. It's not that difficult.
But I think a lot of people give up, you know, when you go to therapy and they hook up with this therapist, and the therapist might not necessarily be equipped to handle them in a way that they feel comfortable with, right? Mm-hmm. And I think people just kind of give up, you know, they think, well, I tried it and it didn't work, so it fails, you know, but no, you have to go and find the person that actually feels best for you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like a female therapist using say person-centered therapy is going to be very different, extremely different from a male therapist using behavior therapy or a female therapist using psychoanalysis, right? It's just going to be a different experience.
I can actually attest to that from the patient side of the, when I was in high school and I was going through all that other stuff I described, I knew there was something wrong, right? I knew there was something, maybe not wrong, but something different. Well, there was something wrong too. And I'm like, at the same time as all of that stuff is going on, I was on, a combination of steroids for my asthma. And they didn't know that whatever my chemical makeup, whatever part of my chemical makeup causes it, decongestants make me nuts. And I have allergies. So they put me on decongestants. I was on a bunch of different pills. Sometimes I took, 7 or 8 pills plus inhalers plus liquids, and I had allergy shots and everything. So like I was a chemical mess in high school. I might as well have been a drug addict, for the effects that I had. And I ended up asking to go be psychologically evaluated. And my parents, outwardly they were like, okay, we can do that. And I think on the inside they were going, oh, thank God. But I went to, they took me first to a female, and she was okay. Like, she didn't do any harm. She took me through some testing, and they took me to a psychologist before I went to an actual psychiatrist. And the psychologist identified some possibilities and then referred me to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist was a man. He was Korean. He had a thick accent. The first hurdle I had to get over was being able to understand what he said because his accent was so thick, and having to explain that to him without feeling like I was being offensive, and being able to communicate that, and the difficulty I had communicating that was actually a clue for him. He didn't take offense at it. He took it as information that he could use to help figure out what I needed. And I think that was that's a difference sometimes you get between Americans and immigrants, at least first-generation immigrants from some countries, is that Americans will look for offense where it isn't. And first-generation immigrants from Eastern countries, from what I've noticed, will look for miscommunication resolution first. And So I ended up, the psychiatrist put me on contracting for the obsessive compulsive stuff, which, by the way, is not fun, because you're basically confronting the compulsion and doing the opposite. So I had to go down a city block and step on every crack in the sidewalk. But in any case, the behavioral stuff that he did actually put me forward. I made progress because of that. And his approach wasn't, we're going to do this and it's going to work. It was, we're going to try this and we're going to monitor how it works. And then if you don't feel like you're making progress with this, there are other things we can try. And if you feel like this is actually causing you more problems, we'll stop it right away. And it was that way with every behavioral thing he did. I had behavioral tools I learned for anger management because of we didn't think about the fact that the steroids that treat asthma might cause roid rage the same way that the steroids that make you have big muscles cause it. And we didn't think about the fact that other drugs that I was on for my asthma and everything might also cause mental health symptoms. So we were basically treating it as if I had a chemical imbalance that was natural. And I couldn't give enough credit. This guy probably saved my life. In fact, I'm pretty sure I could say he saved my life in a couple of different ways at a couple of different times, just helping me deal with the side effects of those drugs. And as the drugs wore off, over time, as I stopped taking steroids for asthma, and I figured out that I can't take decongestants unless I'm going to be alone for a week, that that those therapies ended up becoming tools for me to deal with everyday life. The anger management thing, I still need that. Like, there's no steroids in my system at all now, right? But I still need that. So that's probably a little bit natural. But that difference in, I'm going to analyze you, it's great to have an analyst figure out these might be the pathways that we need to address. But it sure does help to have behavioral therapy. I think for a lot of people, it's probably the real need is for a combination of those things. You can't just do one thing. And I think too often our society, our medical community likes to throw pills at people and say, take this and go home. And next patient, So yeah, I can attest to that from the patient's end of it, that it does make a big difference when the physician figures out you can use behavioral tools to advance your outcomes, your capability of having positive outcomes, ability to work, ability to interact with people and stuff like that. And for me, a big part of it was the ability to work. And I think a lot of men are like that as well. They just need to be able to, I got to have a job, right? I got to be able to support myself. I've got to be able to buy the things I want. I've got to be able to have interactions with other people. And I've got to be able to have the things it takes to make me an individual who can regularly socialize with people. And if you don't have that, you're kind of, it cuts you off from the rest of society. And it may not be the same way with a lot of women, because women have always had that ability to, well, I'm a stay-at-home mom. What do you do for a living? Well, I don't, but I write a lot of poetry, and be taken seriously with that. So they're able to fit in as a normal part of society without having a way in which they contribute to society that they get paid for. And so the therapies are going to be different. The needs are going to be different. The shaping of the outcomes is going to be different. And it's definitely very important that guys be able to pursue the needs that they have for how they change themselves in order to get those outcomes that they want. But I think we've kind of... I think we've gone through just about everything we can on this topic. I don't know. Do you guys have anything that you wanted to add?
Nothing that I can think of. There's quite a wealth of information in the three studies that I found. So if we can link that to anyone who's interested, I can send those over. But
oh yeah, definitely. Actually, if you put them in the live show chat, I can put them in the low bar of the video.
Perfect. I'll do that.
And then I am going to remind everybody, ICMI is coming up. I believe there's still tickets. There's also, you can actually just donate if you want to help to make sure ICI happens, goes off without a hitch and everything. But you aren't able to attend. And I know if you're in the area around ICMI, we usually do meetups. I don't think anything is scheduled, or at least I don't know of anything, whether it's scheduled or not, around the Chicago area. But I believe there will be other events. So ICMI's information is at icmi.info. Or icmi2019.icmi.info. I believe if you just type in icmi.info, you will you'll get the main page, and it actually has a link to it has links at the top of the page to everything, the about page, the presenters, contact, tickets, exhibitors, schedule. If there is, I don't think the fundraiser is still linked on the page because I'm looking at it and I don't see it. So it may be that we actually have hit our goal. But, sorry, it's just going to be that time of year all summer. But the other thing is, if you go to Feed the Badger, you should be able to just go into feedthebadger.com. should take you to the fundraiser for ICMI should be the top of the page. It's been at the top of the page for the last month. So, and yeah, it is still there. There's 186 supporters so far have raised $13,331. And it looks like we still have 89%. We're at 89%. So we just have a little bit left to go. 4 days left in this fundraiser, and hopefully we don't have to start another one. So that's my shill for ICMI. While I've got you here, Anna, have you got anything going on that you can shill?
We do. We are now having our cherry stem almost every week. We're trying to build up to every week, but Patreon promises twice a month at the very least. We've been doing real good on that. So, yeah, check out youtube.com/AnnaCherry if you'd like to support the podcast, which I hope to make a podcast. I kept calling them podcasts, but it's not quite yet. So that's the Patreon goal for that. All the links will be in the descriptions. If you do want to go to patreon.com/AnnaCherry, every single cherry stem we've done is over 30 episodes, is available to the public. Download the audio, check out the resources, catch up on the thing, and that's it for me.
Alrighty, and with that, I think I'm gonna thank everybody for listening, and thanks to my co-host for the
wait.
Oh, you never have anything to shill, so you have something to shill. No, this time
I do. Awesome. I was muted. I was like,
oh my gosh,
I was trying to talk.
talk.
I am going to be taking part in the Lovely Ladies of Men's Rights calendar for 2019.
Woo! Oh yes.
So,
oh, yes.
Yeah, we got Ellie Prizman. Prem is going to be in there. I don't know who else. There's a lot of lovely, lovely ladies of the men's rights who are going to be taking part in this calendar. So if you would like one, please, please. I will, I'll tweet out the link again, and maybe I can give it to you and you can post it.
Yep, put it in the chat.
Yeah.
And so we'll go ahead and link that as well. So
the other thing that I wanted to say while you were talking about ICMI is that I really like the option to there's like a remote viewing option where if you can't attend, you can still buy a ticket and view the conference live, if I read that correctly, which is a really nice option. If you can't make it, at least you can participate and still see what's happening live in real time. At least that's what I understand from one of the options. But yeah, no, if you can make it out, please do. We need butts in seats. And
as many as possible.
Yes. This may be slightly derailing, but I do have a question about ICMI. I did see that Tommy Sotomayor has been put as one of the speakers. Is that still a thing?
I believe so. I have not heard any differently. Let me put it that way. So it looks like...
And I guess we're going at it with the... We're going forth with the understanding that there's freedom of association.
Absolutely.
That we don't necessarily condone the extremely anti-gay remarks that Tommy has said that I have a very big problem with.
Yeah, we have a variety of speakers, and I know that every speaker is going to have something in their history or their statements that the different people are going to have issue with.
Disagreements,
like, obviously, like, there are people that don't like Paul's style, for instance, because he's very inflammatory at times, and you know, there are people who don't like various other people's styles as well. Probably the least controversial we'll have is Tom Golden. He's probably the most
lovable.
You know, yeah. And
well, I believe there's a bit of a difference between a aggressive style versus somebody saying that they would have never gone on Dave Rubin if they knew he was gay.
Yeah.
And he's like, I shook his hand. It's like, oh, bad optics, Tommy. Not good. Not good.
Yeah, no, we're not necessarily endorsing that. But right. The fact that he has a great deal of information about fatherlessness, and
he really does.
You know, this
he
is
really does.
That information is, and you know, as we've said in his bio, he's vilified as racist, sexist, and misogynist. The guy is going to get criticism for a lot of things. And I don't think it's acceptable to say that people can't be homophobic. And I'm saying this as a bisexual woman. People can hate me for that, and it's their business. Yeah. And they can even criticize it vehemently and make fun of it and everything.
But that doesn't just detract being, from the points. Right. If they have good points that, you know.
If they're wrong about that and they say the sky is blue, it doesn't stop being blue because they said it.
I just wanted to throw that out there. It's like, look, there's freedom of association. We definitely do not endorse any kind of anti-male comments and anti-sexuality comments that some people have made. But that does not detract from the fact that they're well-informed and have a unique view onto a particularly vulnerable subsection of men in America, which are African-American men and boys.
Right. So, you know, I didn't hear his comments firsthand, so I don't know the actual wording of them. So I don't know if he was just simply saying he's personally opposed to the lifestyle, or if he's
making people,
nasty statements about gay people.
No, people told him that Dave Rubin is gay and he didn't know. And it was sort of reacting to a live show. And so it could be his persona, but he was laughing and saying, oh, why didn't you tell me before? I would have never gone on the show. I would have never shaken his hand.
Oh, that might have been a joke.
Why didn't you tell me?
Yeah, that might have just been a joke. Right. He might not even have been serious when he said that.
But it is out there, and I just wanted to address that. It's like, look, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
No, but honestly, hell, I make jokes about, you know, all kinds of things that people would probably take them as phobic and stuff like that when I'm talking about myself. So I'm not judging somebody for that. That's silly. That's not even something to get worried about. But no, if he actually had come out and condemned homosexuality and said gay people should be locked up or something like that, it still wouldn't change the importance of fatherhood. And it would be something that, well, okay, so everybody's wrong about something. And you know what? That would be wrong. Those statements would be wrong. But it would still be something to disconnect from the importance of fatherhood.
I've always been in favor of separating the message from the messenger. As in the case of Orson Scott Card and the movie Controversy that they had, it's like, yeah, okay, he may have things that some people find displeasurable, but, you know, how many people worked on that movie? You know, it's one of those things where it's like, if somebody has good research and they happen to be wrong about some things, well, that's where critical thinking comes in. That's where, if you're worried about him giving you bad information, well, look at it yourself. You know, you can learn so much more from just researching it yourself than, you know, taking someone's word for it. So please do double check everything we always ever say. Do research on your own, because you never know. You might stumble onto even more research than you ever thought possible.
Yep. And, you know, the last point I would make on it is when we were in the courtroom at Calgary, it pretty much came out that the idea that we at Honey Badger Radio have told rape jokes was a determining factor in the decision making at Calgary Expo when we got kicked out. Like, now I am a multiple time rape victim. That's not something that I care to talk about a lot. I've talked about it more than I ever wanted to in the context of men's issues and free speech and all that stuff. But, because it's not really an important thing to me, honestly. All of it happened so many years ago that focusing on it now is like trying to pick at a scab that isn't even there anymore.
Exactly. Right? Actual survivors try to move on, usually.
But when I had to deal with dark topics like that, and it's still a painful topic. It's not like, you know, oh, well, it doesn't matter anymore means that it doesn't hurt anymore to think about it, right? It's not scary anymore or something. No, it's still a dark and painful topic. I use humor to deal with that kind of thing. I absolutely will always use humor to cushion dark and painful topics because it works. It helps to deal with the topic. It helps to look at the ugliest things that you have to look at in life. If you can not necessarily lighten the mood so much as make the threat level of the topic seem smaller by a little bit of ridicule. And one of the things that people don't get about rape jokes is we're not making fun of the victim. We're making fun of the rapist. We're making the rapist less scary, less monstrous, more human, more vulnerable, and easier to break down, right? So that's what those are about. But when people can't separate that from the idea of, well, you're promoting rape, when people can't turn around and act like, well, you're actually supporting the idea of rape culture. You're actually supporting the characteristics of rape culture. When people can't deal with the fact that your way of shrinking the monster is making fun of it, then they misunderstand. And I think people are that way with homophobia as well. There's real homophobia. It's very rare. It's something that I've seen it happen. It usually only targets, like, women, you know, want to act like they're part of it, but it usually only targets men. But it's very rare. And, you know, actual genuine hostility to a person just because of their sexuality that results
or
in...
Or Saudi Arabia, where they kill people.
That's homophobia. The idea that people are scared that they're going to catch gay from this gay guy, you know, or that they're people are
hateful.
They
can't watch their children or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, and so people who joke about homophobia a lot of times may be doing the same thing, trying to shrink the monster. You know, not that the gay man is the monster, but that the phobia itself, the attitude itself, is the monster. And
I mean, that's
sounds
at the core of the core of PTSD research. How we deal with trauma is uncoupling the scary, fearful feelings from the topic, and the best way to do that is to replace it with, you know, laughter, because humor at its core is a change of perspective, and at the PTSD therapy is change of perspective. So, you know, it only makes sense that those two would naturally go hand in hand, especially for those of us who use humor to deal with things that happen to them.
Yep, exactly.
Or their loved ones.
We should probably make this a topic sometime and do a whole show on it. Because I think this is something that people really don't have a grasp on. You know, like, basically graveyard humor, confronting tough topics, changing your perspective and your attitude about a topic in order to be able to maintain your functionality within society. It's an important thing that we've always had as a human society, and we're killing it now with snowflakery. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to be tonight. Because we end up with another 3-hour show, which we really don't need to do. So if everybody's done with the shilling, and I think everybody's done with the shilling, I am going to go ahead and close this out. So again, thanks everybody for coming on, and for everybody for listening to us, and thanks everybody who works in the background to help make HBR Talk happen. And good night, all.
Jugular. This is Honey Badger Radio. Radio with Bite.